You've entered the House of Mystery on WXEI, the talk of Crestview, Panama City, Pensacola, Florida, with your hosts Al Warren, Kev Thompson, and Julie Saffon, and The Conspiracy Countdown with Dr. Joe and Stephen David Lampley's Crime Commentary.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery on KKNW Seattle, 1150 AM, Alternative Talk Radio, part of the Hubbert Network. And I'm your host today, Al Warren. Kev Thompson is off on assignment. We are back into the world of true crime, but not from today. Well, sort of, but the actual crimes were something that were happening in the 60s. And of course, I remember them, and a lot of people in my age group do. And it was a totally different time. I love talking about this era and the things and how different they were. And I came across a book, incredible book, called Charles Manson, Coming Down Fast. And the author is Simon Wells. So I've asked him to join me today, direct from the UK. Thank you for being here.
Hey, it's a pleasure, and thank you for inviting me into your lovely, warm studio. It's a pleasure.
Well, we can't afford much, but we can afford that.
I'm delighted, and the coffee's great.
Well, yeah, Seattle, nothing better than the coffee.
Nothing better.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny. I talk about this era a lot, and I have a lot of... it's funny how we compartmentalize things, because when people think of the 60s and what, you know, a lot of times people think it's the good old days, mm-hmm. and how good everything was and how we did everything right. But it's not really always that way, you know, when going through a lot of history. God, we've been through, we had, you know, presidents assassinated, and we had big leaders shot. We had the Black Panthers. We had riots. Just, it was, you know, Patty Hearst and sure. Charles Manson.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with the past is there's a quote, and I think it's Wordsworth, that the past is tranquility and reflection or something like that, which sort of, to me, sort of sums it up, that time gives the past the director's cut. It sort of edits out the horror, and you do tend to sort of have a rosier a view of it. It's like people romanticize about the war. Well, you know, you can't think of anything more horrific than living through a war, but people over here in England will still talk about the war in the good old days, but it wasn't. So I understand that. I mean, the 60s has such a golden glow around it, principally because of how the media portrayed it, you know. So, in a sense, yes, I can see 50 years on that people are still attracted by the flowers and colours and, you know, the smiling, happy faces. But that was really only on the media. I think people were dealing with the harsh reality of living. Yeah. And if you weren't one of the moneyed class, life was pretty tough.
Yeah, and you know, I hear a lot of, you know, because in the U.S. there's a lot of bickering about liberals and conservatives, and you know, it's been a tremendous amount of fighting. But I remember when the liberals were more aggressive and anti-government, you know, and that's the time we're talking about, you know. It wasn't cool to be part of the man, you know, and that whole aspect of fighting the man, you know.
The man was, yeah, the authority, and the man has been on the phone. The thing is that the we're looking at a period where there was an enormous baby boom from the Second World War, where a lot of, I take it right back in the book, and I'm certainly one that pains to sort of go on about it. you know, servicemen returning from war that has joyous reunions with their partners produced this amazing generation, a massive generation of young people. And for many of these young people, it was the first time that they, you know, they didn't have to fight a war, or at least they had more freedoms. In the UK, that's the case. I know in America, you have Vietnam. But there was a sizable population of young people expressing freedoms which had, you know, not been expressed before. And, you know, with the Beatles and with drugs and with liberation on many levels, you know, it was a very, very exciting time. Also mass media, you know, people were tuning in to new realities via television and music and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that was very powerful period. And I think that can't be sort of overstated, you know, enough. That it is, it was a period where young people also were starting to assume a sense of power. They weren't taken seriously before the 60s, youngsters. Mm. And this is where, you know, pop music has actually elevated, and pop music and other mediums as well, has elevated the worth of young people. So they were assuming a sort of power, and, you know, so it was a remarkable time. I always call it a century flower. You know, it's something that happened once every 100 years, and it bloomed in the 60s because of the elements that brought it all together, because of the mass of youth who had access to money and access to more freedoms than their forefathers. And when you have that freedom, you think, because people then were starting to challenge, which was seen as an affront to the elders at the time. So it was a very volatile time as well. As you say, you know, we had riots, you know, we had protests. In retrospect, it all seems rather lovely. Yeah. But the actual reality at the time, it was pretty savage, you know. And if you did stick your neck out and demonstrate, it's more than likely that you've got a baton around your head, you know.
Right, right. Yeah, quite different. The whole subculture thing was very new. And, yeah, just amazing. Now, when you wrote this book, Charles Manson, and you call it Coming Down Fast, I have to ask, what would that be in reference to?
There's a Beatles song called Helter Skelter, which I imagine that your listeners know, which has got the line "Coming Down Fast." It's pretty much at the end where McCartney shouts, "It's coming down, it's coming down, it's coming down fast." And as we know, Helter Skelter was tied in with the whole Manson mythology. So it seemed a good line, because Helter Skelter obviously is the title of the Vincent Bugliosi book, which, you know, is the prosecutor's version of events, and it's his side of the story, and it's very well told. I felt that there was another story to be told, not so much the facts, but actually how one approaches the facts. And, you know, I think the thing with Manson, there's a lot of hysteria in the story, and there's someone who's come through. I sort of have hung out with a lot of alternative communities. I wasn't too fazed by that. I'm fazed by murder, and I think every right-thinking person should be. But actually, characters like Charles Manson, I was at pains to point out, were sort of to a penny in the 60s, especially in California. There was a lot of messiahs and creepy guys who were claiming to be this, that, and the other. So, you know, as far as I was concerned, that wasn't unusual. And also what caused the horror, which has sort of embossed Manson's name into sort of criminal infamy. You know, to me, that there was another reason for this, not the sort of spectacular semantics of Helter Skelter, which, as many of your listeners would know, the prosecutor's interpretation of what Manson was saying about race wars and apocalypse and et cetera, et cetera. To me, it was a bit more mundane than that. So I wanted to sort of rationalize the whole story and bring it down into a level that was a bit more understandable. You know, for me as a sort of a writer who actually sort of is interested in the truth, the first thing that struck me when I heard about Charles Manson was, this is, you know, a serial killer and a mass murderer who didn't particularly kill anyone. And in fact, the one murder which he is jointly associated with, it's possible, it's questionable, that was nothing to do with him as well. So, you know, there's a lot of madness tied up in this story, not just from Manson's corner, but the hysteria from the prosecution angle, who wanted to make this a sort of Hollywood nightmare.
Right, right, right. Well, they wanted to market him as someone that could control your children.
Right.
Right, take over and cause them to do evil things.
Sure.
So...
Well, the thing is, there was a lot of people in the hippie culture who could do that. I don't think he was, I don't think he was sort of special in that respect. I'd be more bothered by Timothy Leary, to be honest with you. The thing is that if he did control people, it wasn't many. And the people he did control were of a certain age. I think anyone of his own age didn't take him seriously. That's evident. That's sort of, how should we say, that's borne itself out by the facts. The things I found out in research of this book was that many people came and went from Spahn's Ranch, the collective venue where this all sort of started from, or certainly was centered in. Many, many people came and went. It was sort of a hardcore of about, well, an inner circle of about 5, 6, or 7, and a hardcore of about a dozen. So to me, this is not, this is not sort of massive guys, the most dangerous man in America is going to take over your kids. This is just a guy who had influence over a small group of very impressionable people. If you want to really talk about cult influence, we can talk about Jim Jones. You know, that to me, that's a real cult leader. I don't think Manson had that.
Right.
I don't believe it.
Well, then how do you attribute the killings then?
The infamy of the killings is down to Sharon Tate, period. If Sharon Tate wasn't included in the murder toll, we would not be talking about this tonight. In fact, I doubt we'd be talking about Charles Manson. It was an attack on Hollywood. It was an attack on celebrity. It elevated the case exponentially to a level which, as I say, I had to trace the murder figures in L.A. from the 60s. That's pretty shocking. And also, as part of the research, I was checking on murders in places like Watts, etc., the sort of impoverished areas, who might get one or two detectives attached to it and signed off usually in a couple of days. The Tate murders alone had 100 detectives. So we've got celebrity all in this story. So that sort of gilds its infamy. And then of course, obviously the prosecutor, who did a brilliant job in actually making Manson, whose crimes were as far as facts concerned, accessory and conspiratorial, into 9 counts of first-degree murder. So he did a fantastic job on that. And of course, but what he did was create Manson the monster. So that's where it's all tied into. But this was my brief. My brief was not to go down the helter-skelter route of the guy who wants to go out into the desert and have a tribe of millions and take over the world. Mine was to show a mediocre, petty busker, small-time criminal with influence over a certain group of people. And one of the other reasons for the title Coming Down Fast was that I traced painstakingly the events leading up to August 8th and 9th, and what happened at Manson's commune and his self-proclaimed divinity was on a very heavy slide, and a series of events happened in the run-up to the murders. So, in a sense, the commune collapsed. Manson's divinity was now in doubt. And as he said himself in an interview, that people were starting to question him. So the last arrow in his quiver, the last thing he had left was to greenlight these murders. So it's really about a collapse of a commune with a self-appointed messiah, so to speak, but the commune's breaking down. So it's a pretty dismal tale. But the infamy, as I say, is in the targets, the house at the end of Cielo Drive, and the fact that Sharon Tate, wife of Roman Polanski, and on her way up to sort of being a pretty much an A-list celebrity, she was on the way to be in the murder toll. So, it's a difficult thing to say. I found it hard to say, well, if Sharon Tate wasn't involved with this, I don't think it would carry the same gravitas. But the story is no less fascinating. I mean, you know, we have the story, this incredible story, but I don't think it's the one that the hysterical media really want to talk about. You know, there's been times I've done TV stuff, and, you know, they've edited out the fact that I said Manson is the world's most famous serial killer who didn't kill anyone. You know, they want to know that he was a maniac.
Yeah.
And, of course, he plays the part as well. So.
Oh, he does that quite well. You know,
doesn't he?
Any interview or anything he does, he looks, he can look the camera right in the face.
Yeah.
You know, he has that stare down and that, if you know, his old, if I wanted you dead, you'd be dead now. You know, yeah. Like he had that, he has that very, very powerful way about him. It's good to, you could sell that easy.
Yeah, I mean, He is what people want him to be, and that's the thing which is interesting. I mean, he's got nothing to lose, and he's, you know, in jail for the rest of his life. I think that he does play that part very well. But, you know, the reality, I mean, the other thing which I think is interesting, and I think that's certainly borne out, is he did sort of desire some sort of fame. He clearly wanted to have some sort of recording contract. I think that's pretty evident from the information I sourced. That he, you know, he was actively seeking some sort of musical career, and obviously in the, you know, the run up to the murders, that sort of collapsed quite spectacularly alongside his, you know, the commune. So I think there's a he's quite probably quite happy being the world's most famous serial killer or whatever, you know, and by default or whatever, but. The truth is, you know, the truth is somewhat, to me, somewhat more mundane.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you say you were collecting testimony from previous members of the Manson family. Now, how was that to do? Like, how did you find speaking to anybody involved?
It's a little problematic. I think that... the approach that this is a story that's been told a few times, and it's been told pretty much with the same approach. So my approach was that I just wanted to totally demystify this, as I said earlier, and just make it into a more of a sort of a human story, rather than some sort of spectacular blood fest of a maniac. You know, and people I spoke to seemed to warm to that approach, which was great from my point of view. And it wasn't, you know, I mean, I wouldn't blame them. I didn't blame them that some of people wouldn't talk to me because they've been duped before, you know. But it is something which I believe there's a backstory to it. I think the truth in what really happened falls between two stools, and I'm sort of keen to try and get to that place where if you take the hysteria away, you are left with a story. People sort of warm to that. And the reception from a lot of people who were involved or, you know, who saw it firsthand, obviously I couldn't see any of it firsthand, but they feel I've got it just about right, which is a great payoff for me, because there was a lot of moments where I felt I could have actually dipped into the, you know, received wisdom and gone for it in the, you know, just hand it over to sort of the popular received wisdom of it, the mythology, I should say. That was good. Obviously, I had to talk about the murders because, again, as I say, you know, we wouldn't be talking now if there was no murders. It would just be another commune in California of which there were loads, hundreds of communes, you know. So that did play its part in it. But what caused those murders is, for me, and certainly from what I came across, in no way what's been previously presented. You know, I don't think Manson really wanted to rule the world and cause a race war. He may well have talked about something similar around a campfire when they're all smoking dope, but as someone who sat around campfires with people smoking dope, people talk a lot of nonsense, you know. And I don't see that as unusual. He talked a lot, Charles Manson, you know. So what we're really looking at is a frustrated artist who felt he had a break in the music industry of the 60s, and it didn't come to pass. I think history would have been different if he had been given some sort of a contract, you know, or some sort of... The thing is, Al, you know, his music, I listen to all his music in the preparation of this, and there's anyone who's got access to, you know, YouTube, you can hear a lot of this music. And from one of the people who was auditioning Manson at the time, said to me that around the campfire with all the girls swaying and, you know, all the smoke and all the rest of it, it was hypnotic, it was amazing, but you bounce that down onto tape, it lost it. It lost so much in the translation. Right. And that was the problem. They couldn't capture Manson around the fire. In fact, Terry Melcher, who was the guy who really had to give Manson the news that you're not going to have a recording contract, interestingly, he had planned to film Manson, think, well, maybe there's a better way we can present him via making a film around the family and do it that way, try and get it across that way, because they were at a loss really to know what to do with it. In fact, if you listen to the tapes now, again, they're all, a lot of them on YouTube, I get the same feeling. It's sort of pretty okay, but only okay. Nothing earth-shattering. I think Manson had been detached from the real world by dint of his prison stint. Didn't really pick up on the BS of the music industry, which is, you know, as we know, is, yeah, great, Charlie, fantastic, you know, we're going to do something with this, it's amazing, you're going to be a star, because he believed it, you know. So there's all that as well. There's so much that really went into what occurred at the end, and I don't think there's any hidden conspiracy. I think if there was, it would have been sussed out very quickly. A lot of people have said this is a drugs hit, you know. But from what I could see, you know, from what I researched, the Manson family couldn't really organise that much. The only drug hit I came across was Tex Watson's drug burn of a dealer, which was so sloppy and appalling that, you know, the mob wouldn't really entrust Manson and his crowd with a major drug hit. I think it's ludicrous to suggest.
I was just going to. So what do you think caused the ending then? What was the final breakdown for him where he wanted all these murders?
Well, we had a succession of arrests within the Manson family. We had the death of a sort of associate called Gary Hinman, which was a sort of biker drug bust, drug burn that went wrong and ended in his death at the hands of a family associate called Bobby Bosley. We had, as I said, it was a drug burn. Again, it was Tex Watson with a known dealer called Lots of Popper, which went badly wrong. So people were starting to question Manson's sort of divinity, and if there was a suspicion of the impending race war, it wasn't happening. Also, Manson's musical career wasn't happening, and people were questioning it. The key for me is that he went, in the midst of all this, he went to a New Age Institute college called Esalen. I believe it's still there. I think it's near Carmel. Big Sur, that's where it is. And, you know, like a last-ditch attempt. Remember, he'd been rejected by Terry Melcher and the Beach Boys management in terms of a music career. And he went off to this place thinking that over a weekend they might entertain him and his music and give him a sort of much-needed push, and they sort of laughed him out. So, you know, he comes back to the ranch at 2 o'clock after this rejection. Again, rejection runs large in Charles Manson's life, from small child, you know, parents, and rejection from society, and then obviously working his way, career criminal. So the rejection is heavy. He hears about the murder of Gary Hinman, the arrest of Bobby Bosley, all the strands leading back to the Manson family, and of course to Charles Manson. Then the rejection from the Esalen Center. So he arrives back at sort of around 2 o'clock on the August 8th. And the girls have said, well, they've cooked up this idea that one way of getting Bobby Bosley out of jail is to do a copycat murder where they write in blood on the walls, similar to what had been written on the wall of the Ghanaian murder. And Manson just went with it and said, do it, and, you know, make it grisly. And it was a psychotic episode, which, with someone like Manson, who had a sort of, I wouldn't say latent schizophrenia, he definitely had a sort of severe personality disorder, he went with. Why they chose Seattle Drive, the house at the end of the drive there, I've got a couple of reasons for that. Obviously, there was a Terry Melcher connection. Terry Melcher eventually rejected Manson. But he moved away. But a lot of people have just said, well, why did they do the house, you know? Manson's sort of prison sensibility, he knew that at the end of the drive was possibly going to be the best place to commit something like this. It was logistically a good place. So that's the reason for that. That's what I think. It was just moments of madness. Tex Watson, who was the sort of principal hatchet man that night, he sort of owed... Manson has sort of extricated him from the drug burn, and spectacularly had shot the dealer. Manson had shot the dealer, and believing he was a Black Panther and believing he was dead. So, you know, there was a debt there, and a sort of criminal debt, which Manson knew all about. So Tex Watson was certainly under orders to repay that. Equally, Tex and Susan Atkins had been sniffing speed, or methamphetamine, I believe. And so they were as high as kites and off the wall. So that really was the reason for it. As far as I've had no other sort of indications there was any other reason for it. As I say, I wouldn't have imagined that the Manson family, the mob, would have entrusted them with a drug hit. There were drugs at the property, and there were known people during the day who were major players in the drug underworld in LA. But I don't see... I've had to look at this as dispassionately and academically as possible. I can't imagine anyone would have entrusted the Manson & Co. with relieving a large amount of drugs from the house. Although there's rumours, you know, the police initially thought it was a drug burn, I should say. They originally thought that was the reason why it went off target for a while, that they were so convinced that it was a drugs bust. So that's, as far as I'm concerned, is the reason for the first night. The second night, as we know, the Larbi Ankins, the first house they went to was previously occupied by a character named Harold True. And Phil Kaufman had been there as well. These, again, were other personalities in Manson's musical endeavours. So to me, it was just, you know, this is the madness, you know, just processed into a reality.
Right.
I don't see anything more than that.
No particular reason to pick Sharon Tate.
I don't even think they knew Sharon Tate was going to be there. Again, the house was just where Terry Melcher lived. It was at the end of the drive. It was going to be populated by quote unquote movie stars. But also Manson's instructions was actually to go to other houses in that drive as well, which for whatever reason they didn't. So the fact it's centered on one place makes me think, well, if it had been on other houses in the same drive on the same night, then, you know, the story would have been different. But there is some suspicion that a phone call was made to the house earlier in the day, and again, that's never really been properly quantified. Maybe they were just checking to see there were people there. I don't know. But from the interviews I got, from the information, I think Manson met Sharon Tate once when he'd gone to the house looking for Terry Melcher, but I doubt he actually knew who she was. And if he did, you know, he sort of hung out. He was a sort of known face in the area. So he would have probably seen quite a few sort of famous people. I don't think he really cared. Again, I don't believe there was any planning in it. I think it was just a snap decision. If he was planning it when he was at the Esalen Center, it's never really been fully explained. And so my own belief is that he just snapped, and that was an office house again at the end of the drive. And this has never really been brought up before, but I thought it was pertinent that you know, it was logistically a place where one could enact this horror, knowing that escape was probably quite easy. So that's my feelings behind it.
And he had a relationship with one of the Beach Boys for a while.
Dennis Wilson, that's correct.
Yeah.
Two of the girls are hitchhiking and they met Dennis. And Dennis used to sort of cruise for girls anyway, so it wasn't unusual. And he had a sort of low-slung ranch. The girls went back there, and then Dennis went to the recording studio. And when he got back, the Manson family had moved in, and it was quite a party. But I think for Dennis, initially, the whole thing was, wow, you know, this is a large group of women who were sort of obedient to whatever needed to go on. And Manson was pretty wacky and sort of probably, you know, great company to start off with. They probably thought he was, you know, what a guy, you know. And in fact, there's an interview in a British magazine called Rave, where Dennis Wilson is sort of extolling Manson's talents and saying that he's going to record for the Beach Boys brother label. So all the stuff that Dennis has spoofed, now I think Dennis got spoofed a little later, but initially it was a party, and so they really enjoyed they enjoyed Dennis's hospitality, but equally I think he enjoyed theirs as well.
Liked all the company.
Can
you associate, like, I know you talk about his early life. Do you think he had kind of an unusual young life?
Unusual to perhaps normal society, but to those who've, you know, you follow the path of criminals, it was quite predictable. You know, you had an unmarried teenage mum who passes the kid around and is brought up by aunts and grandmothers and falls into what we call Borstal over here, and a cruise school, and then junior league prison, and, you know, working his way up the petty criminal. I say petty criminal. He wasn't a great criminal. Let's remember this. He kept getting caught.
Yeah.
This is not a mastermind. This is, and all the stuff he was getting caught for was all pretty basic stuff, you know. So any criminal mastermind was not evident from the early years. But in answer to your question, no, I think he was just what happens when a child is rejected early on and made to feel a sort of outsider.
Yeah.
So, to me, I mean, really get. Sorry, I'm sorry.
No, I was just thinking of the story of his father making him wear a dress.
This was the, well, this wasn't his father, this was his uncle. I believe it was uncle, his grandfather, but it certainly was the people who were caring for him. There was stuff, yes, in the child, in the, but, you know, again, is this unusual in children who are sort of slightly sort of out the ordinary and behave, you know, badly? And back in we're talking, what, the 1930s?
Right.
So it wasn't exactly enlightened times, you know. And he was an outsider at school, you know, so he did things which, it did, in a sense, have an effect later on when he was able to collect young people around him. I think he understood outsiders. And remember, the Manson family, the girls, or the women especially, were all outsiders, and the men to a certain extent, you know. They were all outsiders of society. So, in a sense, you know, he was an outsider. And that was probably born from his dysfunctional childhood. The other thing was, which of course he spent a lot of, half of him, when he was released, what, 67, so he would have been, what, 32, he spent half of his life in jail. So he'd been, in a sense, you know, he takes 16 years off 32. Well, he was probably still a teenager when he was released, even though he was 32. So that was an unusual reality, which made him very appealing, you know. To me, the story gets really interesting once he leaves prison, he's thrown into the summer of love, you know. Right into the, you know, this incredible explosion of love and peace and drugs and freedom. And Manson's right in the thick of it. No wonder he was popular.
Perfect timing.
I hate to say this, but it was impeccable timing.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely impeccable, you know. And I think that when one looks at the story, you know. And you know, in a sense, Al, you know, if he had hit lucky with a record contract, we'd be talking, you know, he'd be like a Jim Morrison or a John Lennon, wouldn't he? Comes from humble beginnings, had a rotten childhood. I don't know about Jim Morrison, but certainly John Lennon had a rotten childhood, you know, lost his mum and dad, and then made a fortune being a rock and roller and an inspiration to everyone. So I've got a feeling, and it was borne out by a few interviews, but certainly Manson had a sort of fascination for the Beatles. And I think, in a sense, he saw himself as coming from humble beginnings and being able to make music and turning on the world. You know, I think he saw it that way. And so, ultimately, you know, this association with the Beatles, he actually, there's a quote of him, he said the Beatles were the hole in the universe. You know, they were very special people to him. So, you know, I think he allied himself with that. He always used Beatle terms. When they had a bus, he called it the Magical Mystery Tour. And obviously, when the White Album came out, you know, he was intrigued by the lyrics, which he drew a connection with what they were saying with his own movements. You know, so. But if there hadn't been the murder and he got a record contract, maybe we'd be talking about the genius of Charles Manson, the musician. You know? Maybe, you know.
Yeah. A lot of people have the idea that, and you saying that you were talking to some of the family members, that he brainwashed them all, it was suggested that they were all under his control when they did the murders and stuff, and that they are still under his control. What's your thought on that?
That's a big question. Brainwashed them. I think he chose those who would do the murders, who he knew that were capable of doing it. Interestingly, Squeaky Frome, who one would assume was the absolute embodiment of Manson's brainwashing, you know, she didn't go on it. So that's interesting to me. I think he brainwashed. It's possible. I mean, LSD is a big component in the Manson family saga. But the time was the time. You know, I was also keen to point out there was a lot of communes where they had sort of people who were sort of self-appointed leaders that people followed, not necessarily murder, but... So I think it's possible they were caught up in the madness of the era, the madness of the time. The other thing was the time was the time. I think most young people now will Google him, you know, and find out, you know, is he on the level that way? You know, I think it was an innocence. Again, is it hard? Is it possible to say innocence of the man's time? Yes, I think there's an innocence there. But actually, for hypnotizing and brainwashing them, I'm not so sure about that. I think they were certainly convinced by what he had to say. And, you know, certainly... when one listens to the interviews at the time, they were enthralled by him. Maybe they believed him. You know, that's the other thing which nobody says. You know, maybe they actually were in tune with him. Maybe that's it. Were they brainwashed, or were they like that anyway? You know, so I think it's a bit of six of one and a half a dozen of the other. I think ultimately they're... you see, the other thing which is always, you know, I'm pains to point out, you know, if he was really demonic and dreadful, then I think most people, even, you know, at that point, they would have cleared off and found something better, you know? There had to be a love and attraction there. There had to be something. So maybe loyalty plays a part in it as well. You know, maybe people were just loyal to the cause. Maybe they believed what he said. So I think it falls somewhere in the middle. I think hypnotized or brainwashed. I don't know. Maybe they were brainwashed already. Maybe that's what they believed in. Possible.
Yeah. Maybe it's just something they were looking for, you know.
It was something they were looking for, and it appeared plausible. I mean, we all believe in something. Does that mean we're brainwashed? You know?
Yeah.
the time was also, the time though, the time was very, it was an innocent time, and I think that without the distraction of modern media, which, you know, it goes into all our lives and informs us in many different ways, and thankfully today, you know, we don't have one news outlet, we have thousands, so you can sort of take your pick. But back then, you know, we're talking a long time ago, and it was a period where people just, you know, the other thing which a lot, I remember someone saying to me that Manson had, he wanted to detach the family from the world, so they didn't have watches, they didn't have clocks, they didn't have days of the week, that's another one there. They didn't have, the time was supposed to disappear, you know, it was going to be an inclusive unit where they didn't, didn't really have much contact with the outside world, so what they were listening to was Manson's music and Manson's talk, nightly talks, and they all shared in that. So is that brainwashing? I don't know. I think it was being part of a community where, you know, that's what they say and they laugh. But the thing is that inside of themselves, they like that. You know, I find it interesting when you get some members of the Manson family who have since said, oh, you know, I regretted being there. Well, I don't think they did. They enjoyed it. They liked the community aspect of it. Mm. So, again, I think it just falls between two stools. But let's be clear that the people he sent out to murder, they had that in them. They wanted to do that. I don't think anyone was forced to do it. And, in fact, on the second night of murder, I think Susan Atkins, she couldn't go through with it, and Linda Kasabian, obviously, was the driver on both nights. She obviously couldn't, but she could drive, so that's why she was chosen. But to sort of take the madness out of it, you know, I think those people had a pre-existing... I mean, yeah, especially going to kill someone, you've got to have something inside you that does that. I don't think you can be brainwashed to such an extent that you just do it.
Yeah, certainly not at that level. And now you mentioned that there's possibly another murder in London that... A cult member was involved with them. Was that a surprise to you?
It was. It was a surprise on many levels, and I'll certainly expand on that. But Sandra Good, who was a... she was in jail at the time of the Tate LaBianca murders. But she was quite a vociferous convert to China. And she'd come from a sort of quite well-to-do family in Southern California, and... San Francisco, that's Sam. And she had a boyfriend called Joel Pugh, and in the popular mythology of the Manson story, that it's claimed that she married him, and she then defected to Manson, and he went on a journey through Europe and ended up in London, and in December 1969, in his hotel room, he was found with his throat slashed and cuts on his arms and all over him, and in very what was later called very suspicious circumstances. I mean, it is suspicious circumstances to find someone who'd slashed their own throat and had marks over them, etc.
Yeah.
And it was also suspected that a very roving member of the Manson family, Bruce Davis, one of the few male members, was in Britain at the time, and it was suspected that he had a hand in this. I mean, this is how it was presented in Alton Skelter, Vincent Bouguereau's book, which was then sort of, how should we say, that went into the mythology, and over the years it sort of like it gathered a lot of moss. So as a British-based author and writer, I was intrigued by the story, but I felt I needed to get to the bottom of this because... to say, as an angle, you know, I never imagined Manson would have any connection with the United Kingdom. You know, he was very much Southern California, Beach Boys, you know, deserts and sun and beaches. You know, there's no way cold Britain would be anything to do with it. But it was interesting. So I went as deep as I could with the research into Joel Pugh, and I discovered that he had an advanced mental health issue, very advanced, when he was in London. And the coroner here had actually investigated it thoroughly, and had come to the conclusion that it was self-inflicted suicide. Rare that it is that people do cut their own throat and slash their bodies in that way. But what was interesting was Bruce Davis in the UK at the time. He may have been, he may not have been, but I wanted to really get to the bottom of this for one reason which came through to me, because there was many associated deaths which were attributed to the Manson family. If you read Helter Skelter, I think you'll find it's 30, or at least the suspicion is 30. But I think ultimately Joel Pugh's death, as suspected Manson family murder, was invoked to sort of ramp up the murder toll to make the Manson family even more demonic than they are perceived to be. From all the information I got, and I've got if people Google Joel Pugh, Charles Manson, I put all my researches up on a website. It just came to me that it was a very sad story of someone who was allied to one member of the Manson family, who that relationship had ended way before. He'd never met Manson Joel Pugh, he'd never been to Spahn's Ranch, he didn't know any of the family members. And it needed explaining, but again, we were then, while I don't think it was a Manson family murder, although I can't actually categorically say it, because there's only two people who really know that. One, Bruce Davis isn't talking about it, and Joel Pugh's dead. But there is a murder by association. He's included in the Manson family mythology as a possible victim, and we have headlines over here every few years. They dig the story up and say possible Manson death in London. But the reality was, I think, that many people were wanting to jump on the Manson bandwagon and invoke deaths all over the place to sort of give the story more horror, you know. As far as I can tell from the murders attributed to the Manson family, but I will stress this, that no one's been convicted. There's only really one, which was the death of a young man whose name was John Hoyt, or otherwise known as Jesus, who was found dead apparently after playing Russian roulette with a fully loaded revolver with members of the Manson family present. To me, that's the only other murder. I mean, we had the big noise about bodies in the desert 5-6 years ago, and that didn't come to anything. So, but Joel Pugh's death is intriguing. It's the story of a young man who with a mental health issue, who was trying to find himself and ultimately found himself dead in a hotel in London, with this association of the Manson family, which had been invoked, embellished, and ultimately swung to suggest a murder. But as I said to you earlier, you know, there's only two people who really know what happened, and one's dead and one's not talking. So, I don't know. All I could do, I was to present the facts and let people make their own mind up. But, as I say, it's fascinating that Mansonism had a connection with the United Kingdom. I'd never have dreamt that when I started the book.
Yeah, especially back in those times. It's not like you traveled so easily as you do now.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Joel was on an extended tour through Europe, and so he was working his way, you know. So, this is the other thing which I wanted to get. You know, this was a celebrity case. You know, there were lawyers desperate to jump on the bandwagon of this to get their own name in the story, you know. If you actually look at the amount of lawyers who were involved with the Manson family to defend them, I mean, there's a lot, and there was probably a lot more waiting to jump on the... you know, to get their piece of fame. So, what are we talking about? You know, we're talking about, you know, the whole thing reeks of celebrity. If it happened today, God forbid, but if it did happen today, you know, that E! Entertainment Channel will go into overdrive. You know, it's a story of celebrity. Take Sharon Tate out of the equation, and we have, you know, let's say we have a couple of revenge killings in a sort of downtown, grotty part of L.A., I doubt it would even get on the news in the evening, you know.
Yeah.
So what we're talking of is this a story about celebrity. The fact that Manson sort of dabbled in Hollywood circles and had connections with Beach Boys and various other people, gives it a sparkle as well, you know. But that's the area. I dare say if one hangs out in the places they hung out, you're going to come into contact with famous people. And if you've got 20 women who are happy to oblige, you know, then you're going to be popular. So, tell a celebrity.
Yeah. Wow, what an interesting take. I've really enjoyed the book. And
bless you. Thank you.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. Now, do you have a website that people can get a hold of? And
I don't, but I think you'll find me. I'm on Facebook, so you'll get me there. I also do a bit of music, so Simon Wells Music on Facebook, you'll find me. And you got me through my Joel Pugh website, my Joel Pugh blog page with all the information. So if people need to speak to me or get in touch or whatever, then they'll get through to me through that, which is fine, you know. It's a story that just keeps on rolling. We're 50 years on nearly from it, and it's just incredible.
Just keeps on going.
Yeah.
Well, again, thank you. Our guest has been Simon Wells, and we've been talking about his book, Charles Manson, Coming Down Fast. And we'll have that linked to our website and page all over for one click if you need to get to it. And thank you very much for being on the show.
It's my pleasure.
Hey, good evening. I want to welcome you to my very first edition of Stephen's Commentary. It's indeed an honor to be with you this evening. Each week we will discuss a mysterious aspect of true crime, forensics, or some related topic. Tonight we're going to talk about just how is it that a police detective knows someone is lying to them. This is going to be part one of a two-part series. I want to start out first by giving you a couple of tidbits about liars and lying. Did you know that in the first 10 minutes of meeting someone new that you will hear 2 to 3 lies? In January, more people lie than any other month. And depending on the circumstances, of course, but if you stay in the bed all day long, this won't apply to you. But the average person can hear up to 200 lies per day. Per day. It's amazing, folks. 200 a day. Before we get started, I need to explain some misinformation that is out there. One of the biggest misconceptions that I have come across in my many years of law enforcement and general living, is, for that matter, is that people will tell me, Steve, I know how to tell a liar because when I talk to them, if they don't look me in the eyes, then they're lying to me. Folks, listen, if that is what you're using to determine if someone's lying to you or not lying to you, stop it, please. You're doing yourself and the person you're talking to a gross injustice. Let me tell you something. People who have Asperger's are not usually comfortable looking you in the eye. People who have PTSD may not be comfortable looking you in the eye. Those with low self-esteem or who are shy are not comfortable sometimes looking you in the eye. If you're using the not look at me in the eye indicator that all people are lying to you, quit, please, please. Now, having said that, is not looking someone in their eye an indicator of lying? Yes, of course. But it's not the only tool you have in your basket. If you're using that as the one-size-fits-all indicator to determine if someone's lying to you, you're doing everybody a gross injustice. Detectives use clusters of indicators. The more indicators, the better. All right, now that I've said that, let's move on. Let me tell you something that may amaze you, and I'm being facetious. People lie to police officers. Yeah, I know, right? But how does a detective know when someone's lying to them? Let's use this case in point. Let's say that a detective has brought a suspect in for questioning in a robbery. After some questioning, the detective just point blank asks the individual, "Did you rob the store?" Now let's say that the suspect says, "No, I did not rob the store." And then let's use another scenario where the suspect says, "No, I didn't rob the store." Now, one of those statements indicates a lie. Is that the only thing we use to go by to determine? Of course not. Just like looking at someone in the eye when they talk to you. But it's one indicator. Now, if the suspect said, No, I did not rob that store. That is an indicator that he or she is lying to the detective. Why is that? Suspects will typically not use words with contractions. It's just one of those things. They typically will not use words with contractions. They will say each word out. They will say, I did not rob that store, instead of saying, no, I didn't rob the store. That's just one indicator. Another indicator that police detectives use, is elusion. It's when the suspect is asked a question, but they allude to their innocence. They just don't come right out and say it. They don't come right out and say, no, I'm innocent, or I didn't do it. They will allude to their innocence. For instance, if asked, did you lock the store this time? Instead of saying, yes, I did not, or no, I did not lock the store, they will say, well, I always lock the store. Well, maybe in the past you did, but we're talking about this time. So what they will do is they will allude to their innocence. All right, another indicator that police detectives will use is eye shift. You're going to have to know whether this person is right-handed or if this person is left-handed. And that's, of course, fairly straightforward and easy to do in an interrogation or interview setting. If the person is right-handed and they look upper right after being asked a question, that is an indicator that that person is trying to concoct a story where a story previously did not exist. In other words, a lie. They're trying to create a story for the question. If the person is right-handed and looks upward left, that is an indicator that they are trying to remember a situation that did occur, or the truth. Now, just the opposite is true for someone who is left-handed. If you have a suspect who is left-handed, he or she looks upper left, that is an indicator that they are trying to concoct a story where one previously did not exist, just like the right-handed person looked upper right. If the left-handed person looks upper right, that indicates that they are trying to remember a situation that did occur, or the truth. Now, again, I can't emphasize this enough. Is that the only indicator, and is that alone enough to decide that a person is lying? No, not at all. By all means, no. But there are indicators. Now, these are just a couple of the indicators that we will discuss, and we'll discuss more next week and go into more detail about a couple other indicators that you can use or that investigators use to determine if someone's lying. I would like to thank you for your time. I would also like to urge you to invite others to listen in to the House of Mystery radio show each week. My name is Stephen Lampley. I'm glad to be here, glad to be your host, and glad to spend time with you. You have a great evening.
Thank you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.